Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Pulley.
And I'm Tom Kosturath.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of June 29th, 2026. All right, what do you got for us, Tom?
All right, you said that date and it actually tripped me up a little bit. Man, it's already July. That's crazy. All right, so the first one I have this week, article from ESET and their research team. It's titled Gamaradon in 2025, Leveraging Tunnels, Workers, Dead Drops, and New Alliances. So ESET's latest research shows that Gamaradon, also known as, I think Microsoft does them, Aqua Blizzard, they have a bunch of other aliases as well. They remain one of the most active Russia-aligned cyber espionage groups that are specifically targeting Ukrainian government and military organizations, conducting at least 35 spear phishing campaigns throughout the course of 2025. Despite being considered less technically sophisticated than some of the other Russian APTs, the group continues to evolve pretty rapidly and really is pretty relentless in their operations. Throughout 2025, Gamaradon significantly modernized its infrastructure by replacing traditional attacker-controlled C2 servers with Cloudflare workers, legitimate cloud storage providers, tunnels, messaging platforms, dead drop resolvers, the whole gamut. Really just building up their infrastructure and making disruption and blocking quite difficult. One of the most significant findings in Gamaradon's collab was Gamaradon's collaboration with Turla, specifically during several Ukrainian intrusions. ESET observed Gamaradon providing initial access and infrastructure, while Turla deployed its own malware, demonstrating those kind of, you know, semi-rare operational cooperation between two FSB-linked threat groups. Rather than relying on single malware families, Gamaradon continued its philosophy of rapidly developing and replacing lightweight tooling, and we'll get into some more of that as I go. ESET documented six new PowerShell tools, updated stealers, refreshed downloaders, and really constant infrastructure rotation, seemingly to, you know, designed to outpace the traditional detections or IOC-based signals. So some of the technical details within this, and there is a lot. So within this article, there is an attached PDF report. The report's about 50 pages long. There's a lot of good detail in this, so definitely anyone that's interested or likes reading this kind of level of technical detail, it's certainly worth it. Please go and check yourself, but I'll try to scrape some of the highlights here for you. Let's start with the Cloudflare workers and their C2 infrastructure. So Gamaradon increasingly leveraged Cloudflare workers to proxy command and control communications. Workers dynamically redirected victims to active C2 infrastructure, and it allowed the operators to rotate their backend servers without updating any of their malware, making it more complicated to block or really leverage or narrow them down as far as that infrastructure is concerned. The dead drop resolver infrastructure, the group increasingly stored C2 information on legitimate services, including Telegram, Telegraph, Pace services, blogging platforms, social media pages, what have you. Malware first queried these dead drops to retrieve current C2 addresses before then communicating with the attacker infrastructure. So the cloud-based, or some of the exfiltration side, Gamaradon upgraded its file stealers to exfiltrate stolen data directly to cloud storage providers. A few of these included Wasabi, Teddy, and Intercolo, if I'm saying that correctly, showing that their use of legitimate storage providers was strong and in play, also helping masquerade their efforts. They do, and one of the most significant from the tech side and the hunting side, I think, here is they did talk about all of their new PowerShell toolkits. There's quite a few. They really focused and narrowed in on six of the specifics. And all of the tools are lightweight, PowerShell-based, and they're meant to do a handful of very specific things like payload delivery, reconnaissance, lateral movement, persistence, command execution. They all have very specific use cases. And the group really does continue to favor PowerShell because it minimizes the dependencies and it leverages the native Windows capabilities. All the reasons we always see threat actors leverage PowerShell. And this one, it's amplified. If you're tracking PowerShell, you're going to be in such a good place, but it also gives you some abilities to consider other things when you're thinking of your PowerShell logging, which is one of the big takeaways for me from this article. Gamaradon also increasingly used tunneling utilities to conceal communications and expose internal services through legitimate tunnel infrastructure. Going this route with those services really does reduce that need for the attacker-owned public infrastructure. And it really does complicate even more so, as we've already marketed a couple things, it really complicates attribution to these guys. The tool evolution, you know, the existing malware families, including those downloaders and stealers, they're repeatedly updated. So all throughout 2025, you said track them, constantly making improvements to their tool set. It really held to that frequent tool revision and often pushing updates immediately before Russian holidays and pausing development during those periods, which was kind of a cool window of note. And then we talked about that collaboration with Turla. So during several intrusions, Gamaradon established access before Turla would deploy the Cazure backdoor. ESET also notes that there is evidence of task sharing among other Russian actors, including UAC-0099, handling validated victims to Sandworm, illustrating those increasing operational specializations within that Russian Nexus ecosystem. So kind of going in a little bit of the details for some of the PowerShell stuff. We see a lot of the low-hanging fruit here, Scott, which I think is the first, is really the big important thing. So we see like the common stuff we talk about with PowerShell. It was robustly evident through all this information. So your things like your PowerShell downloading payloads, you're leveraging your invoke web request calls, your web client calls, that was at the forefront. The leveraging of encoded commands, heavy use, almost everything, and again, it was already mentioned that the tool sets were PowerShell based, but everything is really focused on what can they accomplish with PowerShell, for setting registry keys, calling different other factors into their processes. If you're tracking PowerShell, if you're logging PowerShell, which we talked about before, you think it's such a good place for these guys. There was a lot of the parent-child process kind of complications that we've seen, right? So we see a lot of stuff where PowerShell would kick off WScript, or a VBS script would kick off PowerShell, which would kick off WScript, which would then kick off PowerShell again. It was kind of interesting to see some of this. So we see a lot of the commonalities there. I haven't seen anything as far as like novel techniques as much as I've looked at this to this point. We see other things like other common stuff that are like really good signals for hunting that we've called out in the past as well. Things like your double file extensions being seen in payloads, the leveraging of your temp folders and your user app data local folders. A lot of real common stuff just in abundance and constant. And you can see the way that they look at their techniques, that they shift to try to almost mask their activity alongside what looks common in an environment. That's kind of one of the other big reads I took out of this one. But let me take a breath, Scott, and let's see what some stuff you had to add to this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think your ending kind of statement about how we're not seeing a lot of net new capability per se, but it's like the gambit of more mature security professional from what you've seen or seasoned or experienced, you've probably seen a lot of these things. So it's a great place to say everything in here, have you seen before? Because this is kind of the commonalities of all the behaviors that have been seen for years by many different groups. They might have their own kind of flavor. I think the one thing, because they're kind of writing their malware in PowerShell, they have things in function calls, which kind of changes how PowerShell can be seen depending on how that execution goes. But even within those function calls, they're calling PowerShell sometimes from PowerShell or WScript, depending on what the point of that is. But I think what's also interesting about this is, if you're not even familiar with PowerShell, you know, they do a good job where there is obfuscation and things in the code that they analyze of kind of prettifying it, right? So that it's more readable about what's actually being executed. It might be not exactly what's seen from a data perspective or if you had the sample. But I think it's important to get comfortable with what kind of like commandlets are important to actors, right? I think it's a great example. You can see the commandlets that are commonly being called or put into functions, what arguments are being leveraged. You can easily see kind of the purpose behind those. So even if it's not to directly apply, because you may or may not have that visibility here for this attack, these are common behaviors that other people use. So it's worth figuring out how would I, if I could see this, how could I find this, right? Kind of case example. So you're covering down on a behavior to the fullest you can, depending on how it's deployed. But there's even the single character named executables, right? When they were using R clone as an example to versus Dropbox API to move things, they actually were dropping R clone named 1.exe. So just that traditional human behavior stuff. They're using simple run keys for persistence, but they're also dropping PowerShell scripts or code in registry keys to then call to execute. They have LNK shortcut files and startup folders. So like a lot of that common same stuff as well. And they even have some, I think it was a VBS script, but a VBS calling command prompt, which would be WSHIP calling the command prompt to then call another VBS script. So when we talked about that script interpreter training, there's just so much going on there that I think when you use built-in tools, like PowerShell, WScript, command prompt, all those script interpreters, and you make a modular style malware, I think you'll always be subject to that, right? Because now you'll be calling things in cycles that would just create that whole chain process that you might add a lot of capability from the adversary side, but if the defenders are paying attention at all, their red flags should be popping up. They even had some hard-coded like NS lookup calls, so they're calling some system-based binaries with the arguments of certain DNS servers. So I know like a lot of people rely on public DNS, but you know, in the past, or organizations that may be locked down where they have internal DNS that resolves for the organization, there could be a huge indicator that something's either misconfigured sometimes, or why is something trying to beacon out to DNS when we know we hit DNS internally. Just from a firewall perspective, that's like the one advantage of some firewall ruling and logging that can be beneficial. But yeah, I mean, without like trying to walk the article, those are some of the takeaways. It's definitely worth paying attention to the technical blocks and what they're trying to do and kind of how they're achieved from a code perspective. Because you don't really have to understand code too well, I think, based on their examples, to kind of get the drift based on what they say and also what you see. So it's a great walkthrough. I would definitely put these people on their reading list for not just skimming or reading the sourcing article that kind of summarizes it. It's worth getting into. So I thought it was a great find.
Yeah. What can you apply from it? And one of the other things that stood out to me too in this is the heavy use of kind of non-standard registry locations.
Yeah.
Right? They leverage a lot of registry locations to hard code abilities to pull down payloads, secondary payloads, installation paths, things like that. And they look at ones that we don't typically talk about. And that has me, at least on the surface, thinking that there's an understanding of how telemetry is tracked in these places, since they're using them as kind of footholds to do the installations, pull down the additional payloads. But we're talking like your HKC printer hive, the EUDC hive, some other kind of stand aside ones, like, you know, keyboard layout, like, you know, just ones we don't typically talk about.
Yeah.
App events, abstractions, like there's some interesting ones here that we don't typically see when we're talking about or looking at intel at the threat hunt. And just knowing and understanding some of the tools that are out there, a lot of registry locations aren't naturally tracked. You kind of, there's usually things you have to do to get registry data in most tools. You have to be purposeful about it. So something to consider as you're thinking about this or looking through this. We've talked before about, you know, kind of the obscure registry keys and, you know, not necessarily having the telemetry form or having to consider, do I have the telemetry for these? And I can't help but wonder if that's why they targeted so many of these, what I would, you know, air quote as abstract registry locations, which was kind of neat. But yeah, really good write-up. Definitely check it out. Lots of stuff here to go after from a hunting or detection area. But yeah. All right, Scott, what's next, man?
Yeah, so the next one I thought was just kind of an interesting article because we talk about a lot of times, helping us either with some coding or when we try to do emulation or just try to understand things. People do oftentimes nowadays rely on some AI solution, right? Some LLM or whatever. Well, there's also been a larger adoption of kind of like agents or coding agents and things. And I don't use a lot of the add-on agents or extensions for coding software yet. I know that's also really popular. So it's kind of like right there in your interface as you're like typing or coding things. But this article from Adversa, it's a blog. It's called The Guardfall, a Universal Shell Injection Vulnerability in Open Source AI Agents. And basically, it's just calling out that, you know, a lot of the ways to bypass security tools in general is obfuscation. Or you find out like, hey, if I pass certain characters to say PowerShell or pass it to shell or pass it to whatever I'm trying to execute in for that type of scripting interpreting language, there are certain characters that might be ignored, but do exist. Like I was just looking at something this morning where someone was injecting null characters between each character, which is a real character, right? At a code level, there is a byte there that represents a null character, but the interpreter could care less. It just ignores it, right? So it makes detection sometimes, depending on how it's detecting, hard. Well, a lot of these AI agents that are helpful for coding, they're finding that guardrail or the help prevents code from executing on your machine with your privileges, depending on how you're reading things in or where you're sourcing things, isn't really a true guardrail at all because they're looking for like the perfect string matches. I mean, you kind of think of, hey, I'm going to write a detection in a sim for an activity and it's got to be verbatim. And then now someone uses obfuscation, you know that detection is not going to work because it's not going to look the same, right? It's the same concept. So this kind of old trick that had been played out numerous times, they found a lot of those AI agents don't protect against. And I want to say, if not all of them, there's one, I'm trying to remember the exact name of it, that apparently was one of the only few ones that did a good job. I'm trying to figure out. I'll track that down here in a minute. But so, yeah, it's just kind of making people aware that, you know, personally, I'm kind of shocked because I felt like this is where AI in general should be better fit for, is people trying to manipulate strings to get things to execute and it, to understand that that's what's going on versus it being just a one for one match in a lot of these cases. So it's just a really good write-up about the testing they did. They show some examples of the techniques they were using to bypass some of these controls that are supposedly exist. And it, as simple as where even like the README files and libraries, there could be code hidden in there. And as you pull things, that will be read in, because the README file is usually, you know, read by the AI agent to understand or try to understand, you know, what it needs to do to run the code that's pulling in or the library is pulling in, and they might actually execute something because of that. So there's like some simple things that attackers might be able to leverage against coders who usually have some sort of elevated privileges if they're not paying attention to how they're using these agents or how these agents are really safeguarded. So an interesting read. I think it brings up a good concept. I always find it interesting in general when we see old security things kind of get breath of new life, you know, breathe into them, because this happens all the time. I feel like, you know, we'll hear about an attack and we'll be like, oh yeah, that was crazy. And then all of a sudden, like years later, you're like, oh, the attack is back kind of in a new way, but same thing that we should have already dealt with or known about. Right. So just kind of like one of those. So yeah, I was kind of curious what your take was on it. It's more of an interesting read with some kind of cool examples and things that, you know, from an obfuscation perspective, you know, there's probably some hunts you can build off just some of the patterns or things seen that they use that are kind of worth paying attention to. Because sometimes obfuscation is enough. You don't have to know what's going on, but if you can detect obfuscation, you know, well, this might not be normal, right? It might be worth looking at. So knowing how people, how things get obfuscated or changed, also kind of a good thing to put on the list.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, the first thing I seen when I read this was, okay, I understand as we're aging through this AI, I don't know, movement, revolution, generation, I don't know what you want to call it, bubble, whatever the flavor is you call the AI thing. The agents are going to become dime a dozen. They already feel like they're dime a dozen, right? And for the most part, they're helpful, right? So it's weird. And I'm going to go back. I'm going to date us a little bit, Scott, here. But I go back to way long ago days when we were chasing down various random things users would pull down to help make their job easier, right? So think of like your PDF editors, man. Think about the battles we've gone against like random PDF editors for no reason. And I think about that, and my first thought with this was like, okay, this is obviously more scary than that, because these AI agents generally have some inherited trust connection to things, right? Like they usually have access to do things in most cases, read things, access certain files. You're granting them a bit of a trust cloud when you put these things on your system. So my first thought was like, okay, well, you know, I love unstructured hunts. I love thinking about, okay, well, what's out there? Know my environment, all the things we keep talking about. And I'm like, you know, if you don't know if you have AI agents on your network, you should go check, find some creative ways to go look at them. Maybe start with a lot of the known popular ones and track back. And I think from there, once you kind of understand what's going on in your environment from an AI agent perspective, I'd be curious and I'd be wanting to look at what kind of processes these things are kicking off and look to see if I could see any standout things. Like, is my AI agent supposed to be launching, you know, PowerShell and then doing other things? And like, is this the process? Like, to me, this screams get ahead of the game here, get familiar with their environment right at the top of this new revolution, and understand what these things are doing in your environment. As a threat hunter, this is what that article sparked in my head, if that makes any sense, Scott.
No, I mean, like, I would say, like, you kind of hit the nail on the head for, I think, a great way to understand how to identify when something goes rogue or goes sideways is, you know, these agents are going to live in some form or fashion. They're going to be kind of independent on your system. They're going to be part of another application on your system. But there's going to be some sort of process lineage that occurs. So you'll know from a day to day, how does that process interact with other processes? Does it create processes? What creates it? If it gets spun up by something, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. Like, I haven't dug into myself, but like you were saying, you can probably easily see when it starts doing things that are either net new and it's like, well, why did it do that? Or, you know, what happened in terms of that would probably be easily identifiable and easy to trigger off of, almost like if you have good logic to hunt adversary behavior and adversary uses one of these AI agents to do something through an attack vector, then won't it look kind of the same because they're trying to achieve the same objectives? You know what I mean?
But imagine in theory, it should be at least in a parallel wave, right? I mean,
right. So it's almost like just a simple, it's like a new beachhead almost.
Yeah. Basically, that's basically what we're talking about here. And I think, like, if we set aside the whole, you know, the AI insanity, right, the mysticism of AI, and like, oh, okay, yeah, it's an AI agent, and oh, it's gotten hosed, and oh, it can do all these things. It's like, well, yeah, it has access to a lot of stuff. So if you can hose this agent and it is allowed to talk to different things, it's allowed to pull stuff from your credential stores, or it holds certain keys, or it does certain API calls, and now suddenly the thing's hosed, yes, it's going to have access to stuff. So it's just like, but the concepts, like you're saying, are still there. Like, the commonalities of how these things would achieve the thing they're trying to do are still in the same line of behaviors, you know, because that's how these systems work. It's just a new way, new tool to do the similar things in the same system, right?
Right.
The only, I guess, scary part is when you have something that has that much kind of that much of a trust cloud that comes with the use of it, a lot more can happen a lot faster if it's hosed.
So. Yeah, it's easy for like the hose to be open before you even know what's coming out of it. You know what I mean? Because like something like this hits and you start leveraging it, it can do a lot more very quick. And if you don't even know to look, then you know a lot can happen between then and now before you like, oh, maybe I should check this out, or something came across my radar and it's, I think it's associated with this. Like, why do we not know about this? Like, sometimes security is just kind of getting ahead of the game by knowing what's going on versus trying to figure out what's going on, I guess. So, yeah.
You heard it here first, Hunters. If you ask yourselves, do you have AI agents? And then ask, what are they doing?
Yeah.
And you're off and running. That's it.
Yeah, it's kind of the first steps. So yeah, just a thought piece that has some cool examples in there and kind of something that might help frame a problem that people maybe aren't tracking.
Awesome.
All right. So what do you got now for us?
All right. Blog post from JFrog. You know, it's our weekly discussion about supply chain things.
Yeah.
You know, almost like I honestly, in full disclosure, I look and I see like, should I include these things in the call as I'm going through my research for what I might talk about on the show, Scott? And unfortunately, we're still in the realm of the very thick of this realm. So of this area. So I'm going to keep talking about it. So there's a blog post from JFrog Security titled Hijacked NPM Packages Use Novel VS Code, Auto Run, and Blockchain Dead Drops. So JFrog researchers uncovered two hijacked NPM packages that introduce a novel execution technique by abusing Visual Studio Code tasks instead of traditional NPM lifecycle hooks. This allows the malware to remain compatible with that NPM version 12's new default protections against install scripts, which is kind of like the big point, right? We just talked about that. I believe it was last week before, and it's like, hey, we already have something that's going around that nugget, which is exactly what we anticipated, right? Rather than executing during the NPM install itself, the malware will wait until a developer opens the project in VS Code, where a hidden task automatically launches the payload. And this really does talk to that evolution of, hey, we're looking at putting defenses up. The attacker's already going around you. One of the campaign's most unique techniques is its use of blockchain transactions as a dead drop infrastructure. So instead of hosting encrypted payloads on attacker-controlled servers, the malware retrieves configuration and JavaScript embedded within blockchain transaction data, basically making takedown almost impossible. The ultimate objective is credential theft and cryptocurrency theft across Windows, macOS, and Linux, demonstrating also the attacker's continued shift towards that compromising developer workstations across all of the OSs, and not just one. So some of the technical details in this, the malicious packages create a hidden .vs code and tasks.json directory. A task name ESLINT-check is configured with the run-on folder open. And it's simply opening the project in VS Code causes the malware to execute automatically without requiring anything or any other call or leverage or need to do anything else with NPM. The malicious payloads, it's hidden within what appears to be a legitimate font file. So you see the payload under the directory for fonts. Rather than containing font data, the file executes as a Node.js script when launched by the VS Code task. So some of the details around the blockchain dead drop, instead of downloading payloads directly from attacker infrastructure, the malware will query the blockchain transaction data, extract the encrypted JavaScript embedded in the transaction metadata, decrypt the payload locally, and then continue on with the execution. After retrieving the encrypted JavaScript, the malware establishes comms with the attacker-controlled infrastructure and then deploys a socket.io backdoor, downloads a Python-based credential and cryptocurrency stealer, and then begins harvesting the sensitive data, doing its thing. The final payload targets what we would expect from a stealer. You're talking browser credentials, cryptocurrency wallets, developer secrets, authentication tokens, and then any hard-coded local files of interest. The malware, again, as I had mentioned, does go after you know, primary operating systems, Windows, Mac, Linux. And then, you know, those bypassing, this is the other one. This is really the primary note that I took out of this, is that we can't fall asleep at the wheel with this. I think this is going to continue to be an evolution that we need to be paying attention for. And I don't know yet that we have a really strong solution across the industry to really attack this. But that bypassing of that NPM version 12 protections, it's just, I'm not trying to be humorous about it, but it's hard to not chuckle of how fast we're already talking about that being beaten, right? Mm-hmm. And that's no shame on the NPM's attempt to it. It's just that, like, this is kind of like, should be a unified discussion, not one specific area that should solve this problem for us, but yet we need to work together to kind of consider these things. But because the way that it's bypassing those protections, that execution occurring through those VS Code tasks, instead of the pre-install, install, post-install lifecycle hooks, just nukes all of that security stuff that's there. It doesn't even matter. Of course, it will require the developer to execute and launch in VS Code, right? So it's, you know, you have this hurdle you need to go through, but there's already a clear method of getting past some of that holdback. One of the things that I took out of this, Scott, because we've talked before about, and I've talked in abundance about it, I probably will all year, honestly. I might get a shirt made, honestly. I've spoken about it so much, but we've talked before about Node and, you know, launching suspicious processes. Like, if you see Node hit your environment, suddenly it's kicking off PowerShell, WScript, things like that. You know, we always kind of go to that process lineage. One thing that I took away here that I haven't necessarily thought about, because we haven't really seen the evidence of it, and maybe we just haven't talked about it. What about Node executing things that have weird extensions, right? So like in this specific case, you see that the payload extension is like a .woff or .woff2, or you might see Node executing things like image files or random media files that are just completely aside from anything this should be doing, right? So just another like nugget to consider as you're like tracking Node doing things it shouldn't because it's being so heavily leveraged, even in this case where you're kind of getting that skirt around to make things happen through the VS Code task portion. That's still something to consider, I think. But yeah, you know, what did you think about this, Scott?
No, I do think kind of like your leading comments where there's controls being put in place for the way attacks looked previously, but this is where, you know, whoever owns the framework for NPM packages, how they get built and what capabilities are there. Pretty much any way you can open up a shell command, any method or function, that's what should be scrutinized and audited from the owners of said thing, if they're going to put controls around stuff, because that's always going to be the next step, right? If there's something you can basically open up a shell like command that you can pass any standard type of attack language and process through, that's going to be tried, right? So how you control it is the next decision, but knowing of all those angles, because, you know, like for instance, this is the first time I knew that you can do it off of a folder open, but like how many other triggers can you build into something to likely do something like that? And then as you know, if you're the maintainer of like the whole library or process or the whole Node runtime environment, you know, maybe you look at developing, well, what's the reason we created this capability, and are there guardrails we can put around it, you know, based on what the intended capability was? Because that's the other thing. Sometimes these capabilities are so open that you're like, well, that's not what we expected people to do with it. It was really for this. And it's like, well, write it for that then, you know. I know that sometimes that might be harder, but, you know, those are things when you think about protecting something, you know, should be kind of the considerations. And the other thing I do think, I've always thought about, you know, even from like an insider threat perspective, extensions are always an interesting conversation because, you know, not saying it's going to be true in every instance, but, you know, like Windows has some native directories that are called pictures or called music or called whatever. Knowing when extensions hit those directories that don't fall into the category of those folders could be interesting. Could be someone who's staging data because they want to exfil it, or insider, and it's where they're hiding things. It could be a number of things. But sometimes there's a story there. And same thing when you know there's an executable that runs a specific file type. And you can see from the command line arguments, even that it's running a file without extension, you know, which could be suspicious, or a different extension, because you know that that wouldn't make any sense. So anything out of the ordinary is kind of like that detective perspective. So I think being able to basically discover that is good. What gets challenging with those really broad things is sometimes they can get very like complicated very quick, depending on how you're trying to solve it or what tool you're trying to solve it in. But those ideas, I think, are very fair and useful. But yeah, like the, you know, it's just another way for them to basically drop in code and kind of start doing the same thing they've always been doing. So, you know, I think the biggest takeaway is how well do we know, like I mentioned before, are there ways to run or hide how code can execute and where it executes within these packages? Because that's really going to be the forefront in how to basically discover or possibly protect against it.
Yeah, for sure. And something, one last thing too, as we kind of, you know, evolve on our talk about knowing your environment and just kind of pitching things that are more on the surface instead of very direct hunt. I think we talked in the last few shows where we discussed like file telemetry, right? And how some of the telemetry for like access to file locations and things like that aren't necessarily out of the box for standard audit policies or standard tooling. Might not be necessarily logging them. So something to consider and think about as far as knowing your environment that's pointed out in this one is, are you tracking, like a question to ask yourself as a hunter or somebody working in your security operations area, are you aware of what's accessing any of your credential store locations, even just your browser credential store locations, right? Like your basic, what is it? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. It's like Chrome default login data location, right? I think that it kind of, the path is similar to that in every system, Mac, Windows, Linux, et cetera. Do you know what's accessing that? Do you have any idea what's touching that? Because that could be a clear signal of something that stands out to you if you're able to kind of track, you know, what's normal versus not. And definitely something to consider if you're considering what telemetry might I not have or what might I be blind to without needing to do a very specific hunt and then learning in that heat of the moment situation where you need to find something and you realize you don't have telemetry. So a good question to ask, you know, are you looking at what's touching your credential store locations at all? Something to consider.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, what's last this week, man?
So yeah, last one, kind of another technical one. I'll try not to go too much in the weeds, but it's by Blackpoint and it's a gen in the machine, Taskweaver's Node.js intrusion chain. So the adversary pursuit group, they identified two previously undiscovered malware samples, Taskweaver and GenStealer, which I've heard of both those. So I don't know what they mean by undiscovered, or maybe that they were existed in an attack that no one knew about, I'm guessing is how that's supposed to be phrased. But basically, it led from the attack of an active exploitation that was tied to the CVE-2026-48558. CISA actually added the simple help authentication bypass vulnerability to its known exploited vulnerabilities catalog. But this vulnerability, so simple help is an RMM tool, that remote monitoring and management tool, like we've seen where, you know, remote help desk or support or, you know, individuals use to try to help get into systems remotely and, you know, manage them remotely essentially. Well, the vulnerability allowed you to basically any of those simple help instances that are out there, you can bypass the authentication and log right in. And then you kind of have the privileges based on, you know, what the system provides. And in that process, that's where Taskweaver, which is a downloader, was basically installed. And then later, the GenStealer was installed. And they actually tied those two things together. And one of them was they had shared an RSA key and used the similar obfuscation. So I always find it interesting when people were able to kind of like take things that likely wouldn't be the same unless there was a relation. RSA key is kind of a big one though, because, you know, those are kind of randomly created. So So that's of some interest. But when one of the things you can kind of do to look if you use Simple Help or you have a Simple Help deployment, in the logging, you can see the IP addresses that are connecting and on a login event. And that might be an easy way to tell something's there, but also the tech user, because it's an unauthenticated attack, I believe you can almost put anything you want in the tech user field. So anything that would potentially be outside of your domain or whatever associated in using the Simple Help, that might be another way to say, hey, here's a weird thing, right? It's a Node.js runtime that's being dropped for the Task Weaver basically to run. But to take note, they show kind of the execution chain of this. I don't know what the Simple Help executable structure really looks like, but after you get past some agent executable with the con host, which is usually con host is associated with like remote connectivity management, command prompts kicked off. So you got command prompt and then kicks off PowerShell. So you already got the script interpreter training we talk about. It's passing an encoded command. Encoded command is the Node.js runtime. And that PowerShell, because it's an encoded command, it then runs another encoded command. It's PowerShell kicking off PowerShell. That's the one benefit of double encoding is a lot of times when you have double encoding for encoded commands in PowerShell, it will kick off a chain of PowerShells for every encoding. And then the child of the last encoded PowerShell command is Node, essentially running the Task Weaver execution. So the whole chain of events there is kind of telling that there's also something weird being executed. They show some interesting like code blobs about what Task Weaver like looks at, information it kind of collects, kind of how it tries to communicate as well. Not all of it necessarily easily identifiable from a data perspective. But then they, when they start getting to the gen stealer, I think this is always interesting because I always like to pay attention to how stealers target their data and what they look at. Because then there's some potentials of like, okay, I can't sit there and say if any file is accessed on my machine, but if I'm able to get data for if this file is read and what's reading it potentially, that could be really strong because some of those are just unique and are only really interacted or exist for one reason. Like for instance, like SSH keys, right? You expect only SSH to really read or look at keys in the system typically. So things like that, you might be able to focus in on. Also, I mean, it creates a lot of reconnaissance artifacts as far as like process listing, Linux process environment, environment telemetry, user directories. The only thing is it's using the JavaScript to actually run those. So it's not going to be coming from a unique process like we normally see with lulbins to do all this. It's kind of done in code. So, you know, unfortunately, it be coming from Node is like the process is doing it, but you won't see any like the little bin activity. It's usually tied to discovery, which is good for them because it's kind of a low profile discovery. Usually discovery can be loud, but they have these collect rules. Now those are the most interesting because the collect rules are shows how they target cloud environments. So you kind of get an idea where are these things stored, sensitive data on a machine when it's associated with cloud or when it's associated with AI development tools. They have that whole list there as well, or associated with cryptocurrency, you know? So, you know, understanding that lets you know, even on your own system, you know, if you're worried about, hey, you know, if a hardware gets lost or hardware, if a hard drive gets lost and you know these things could be on there, yeah, you know, that's one way you can sit there and validate there's nothing sensitive if you look for these things specifically, just to get an understanding of what data exists in your environment, potentially. So it's even a good discovery there to say, hey, how do we classify our data and what we consider this sensitive because of X as a governance type of mechanism you can learn from this stuff. So yeah, they kind of walked through some of the capabilities. You kind of saw the initial, how everything, one, they took advantage of a vulnerability and then the initial execution. I always think that's why I like the initial execution pieces to get dug in, because that's usually where you have the most visibility depending on how malware runs, because sometimes malware is able to do less or potentially hide itself in different ways. So looking at post activity is not as easy, but it's all dependent on the malware and telemetry you already have. So yeah, just kind of an interesting application of where a vulnerability goes to using a loader to a stealer and kind of how all those pieces work together. A little simple write-up with some good nuggets of just information to learn from.
Yeah, good ideas too. Specifically, some of the stuff that stood out to me, Scott, was around the usage of RMMs and remote management tools, and how it seems like it is a mainstay or kind of a focal point to go after those tools by this threat, right? Mm. They did point out something that I thought was kind of a cool thought process from a hunting perspective in the recommendation portion, where they talked about detecting suspicious runtime execution when a remote management software were to launch things like Node or PowerShell or Python or Bun or anything like that. And then also tracking kind of like seeing that execution chain coming from non-standard locations, right? So again, this feeds into that a lot of what we talked about, knowing your environment, understanding what's where. The remote management software thing is heavily leveraged by all kinds of threats and all kinds of different versions of those softwares, including taking advantage of stuff you already have on front, like you're already leveraging, right? Like we see that over and over again. So that was something that was cool. It was a different angle for a lot of stuff we talked about. So looking at kind of that process lineage, remote management software is doing something it shouldn't. I also found it interesting that they talk about some of the things that this is going after that I don't think we've really, I can't think of a time where we've specifically seen this called out, but where it's going after specific configuration files and like, you know, your MCP information and configuration files and other things there. So not just your credential stuff, but it's looking for how you have stuff set up, how you're doing things with your AI agents, like it all kinds of chains together, right? But just a couple call outs.
Yeah, it's interesting how adversaries kind of learn what's important to a user, and it's usually important because there's some level of value of getting things done or a level of access associated with it. And since we are really good at organizing our work, it makes it also easier for attackers to organize their stealing capabilities. So like I said, yeah, kind of cool. Some thought-provoking things there as well. So I think that kind of wraps it up for the week. So I really want to thank everyone for joining Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next time. And with that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of June 29th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.